to be taped. I suppose I'll have something better than rock music to listen to on the way back, you know, to Berlin, listening to the sound of my own voice. The paper that I'm presenting today is part of ongoing work, which is another way of saying I'm going to pick your brains. So I'll present a paper, and hopefully from the questions, sharp and incisive questions that you ask me, I shall be able to develop the paper without acknowledging any of your input, which is generally the way how academic papers function. So what I'm going to speak about here is connected with a larger project that I'm working on, which is looking at the nature of colonial modernity, which is to say that most Indians are dissatisfied with the idea of modernity. They increasingly want to, Indian historians would like to put the word modern in modern India within quotation marks, to make that the subject of interrogation. In what way are we modern, if indeed we are modern? Because as far as most Indian intellectuals go, Indian modernity seems to consist in developmental violence, in state violence, and in actual terms of the quality of life, India doesn't appear to be becoming any more modern than when I was a child. So that's a larger framework, questioning the idea of modernity, and also to try and look at a particular tendency within Indian history, which is to write Indian history in terms of a sense of lack, which is how I began my abstract, that of all of Indian history is really a collective veil by Indian historians, sociologists, and anthropologists, where we are saying, well, we haven't become modern, we haven't had capitalism, we haven't had revolution, we haven't had Marlon Brando. You can multiply depending upon which sphere you're speaking about. And so when I look at something like autobiography, I'm actually looking at also a vexed question in Indian history, which is the question of whether there is individuality and what place the individual has within the Indian imagination. Because when we think about modernity with all its criteria, one of the criteria is certainly one of interiority, a notion of a definite bounded self. Now, can one think about Indian autobiography, and in what ways is it different? What ways is it comparable with similar developments? And obviously there are problems here, because with most of these, the paradigm, the referential point is that of Western interiority. So very often when Indians begin to write about autobiography in India, they're taking as their reference points the classic moments of self-revelation, starting from St. Augustine through down to Rousseau, and looking for a sense of the private, a sense of the interior, and a sense of reflection within a social and moral continuum. Right? So very often when working within these paradigms and not from a sense of what the traditions available within India, I think we are back to the kind of problematic that we started with, which is to say, well, we do not have interiority as we have in the West. We do not have autobiographies along the lines of that sense of I beginning to recognize myself as an I over time. So this is the problem that we're actually looking at. So is this failure of a sense of individuality to emerge, is it to be added on to the other senses of lack in India? So along with capitalism, etc., we don't have a notion of individuality. If you look at the existing historiography, I mean, you remember Orwell's famous statement, all men are equal, but some are more equal than the others. So in one sense, in India, individuality seems to be available to some. Some appear to be more individual than others, if you look at the historiographical and theoretical traditions that we have. So for example, there you have those who work from largely within the Western paradigm and then try and apply this and say, okay, if the lineaments of individuality consist of a recognition of oneself as an individual, as also a recognition by others that one is an individual, then probably individuals are hard to find in India. So you have the work of Matteson Mines, for example, an extremely wrong-headed book in my view, which looks at the notion of great men and how they come into existence in India. So it's almost as if those with access to wealth, those with access to prestige, only they have the possibility. Only those with cultural capital can actually become individuals. Others remain trapped within that collectivity, which can be called caste, community, etc., etc. They never manage to break themselves free. Or you have the very early study, which actually Matteson Mines is a distant echo of. You remember Milton Singer's work way back in the 1960s, where he was looking at industrialists within South India. And again, it was an attempt to look at the evolution of the Protestant ethic within India, which would then enable the emergence of individuals forging their way through business, enterprise, and so on, cutting themselves free of caste, kinship, religion, and all those other deeply undesirable qualities within modernity. So you have these kinds of models, or you have within a Dumo and a certain Indological tradition as well, it is the renouncer, it's the ascetic who has an access to an individuality, not everybody. Certainly Dumo wouldn't have thought of lower castes as having any access to individuality. Lower castes are condemned to eternal replication. Dumo's most devoted disciple, Michael Moffat, argues that there is no such thing as lower caste culture even. It's just a replication of upper caste culture. So therefore you can't have individuals except within this very strict paradigm. Or you can have, in the kind of historical work that's emerging of late, if you're looking at Sanjay Subramaniam, Velcheru Narayana Rao, and David Shulman's work, who are looking at 17th century South India, the rise of the Nayaka kingdoms, as they call it, following the demise of the Vijayanagar, where they argue that there is a moment in South Indian history where kingship is suddenly freed of the trammels of a dharmic kingship, where if you are imagining the ideal king within Indology, is a figure rather like Woody Allen, and he's constantly angsting, you know, about his being a king. I mean, am I in the right? Am I in the wrong? You know, will the Brahmin approve of me, and so on. And so what Sanjay Subramaniam and David Shulman have invented is a James Bond type of king. You know, they speak about the Rayas, who are people who are full-blooded kings. So they, as they say, it is a moment in South India where Shudras are proud to be Shudra. They're free of that deference to Brahminical authority. So you're speaking about individuality as existing among kings who revel in pleasure, who revel in their body. So there is a certain kind of poetics of the body and of hedonism which is being articulated in the 17th century kingdoms. But remember, all of these are speaking about special instances, whether Dumo or Sanjay Subramaniam or Matteson Mines and so on. One work which has found no takers or indeed no parallels, because it is a work that is demands anthropological work of a very high order, is James Freeman's work on Muli, the untouchable in Orissa, which is a book which stands on its own. There have been no books like it since the 1970s, where James Freeman constructs the life of Muli, who is a Bowery untouchable, and looks at the untouchable's life very much like the life of an ordinary individual anyway. His ups and downs, his moments of self-abnegation, his moments of pride, his moments of defeat, dignity, and so on. But within that structure where he's relating to upper caste Brahmins and so on. So Muli's work has found no takers. Now, when one looks at this, one might think, is this an effect of historiography then, that we don't have autobiographies? But then the significant thing is that in India, autobiographies seem to be very late in coming. I mean, the first autobiographies seem to start appearing around the 19th century, late 19th century. Of course, if one is to discount early Jain texts like the Ardhakathana, which was the 17th century of a Jain merchant, one is to discount those as one-off incidents. It's the late 19th century which really sees the period when autobiographies come to be written. And so one is drawn increasingly towards the idea, perhaps, that what we have here is the imagining of a collectivity. So we can go along with something like the Benedict Anderson argument, perhaps, if one wishes, that he twins the nation and the novel. Perhaps what we need to twin here is a nation and autobiography. That increasingly, the autobiographies that come to be written in India around from the late 19th century onwards are the autobiographies of people who have been involved in social reform or in the larger political movement. So, as I suggest in the abstract, when you have Frederick Jameson's rather apodictic and fatuous formulation of third world literature as national allegory, this is largely a refusal of Jameson to actually read third world literature if he sees national allegory in all of third world literature, which collapses Najib Mehfooz and Salman Rushdie and Pramod Yanantatu are all into one category. It's all speaking about the nation. But we can suggest perhaps that if we are to follow Frederick Jameson, that what we can actually see is that third world autobiography rather than the novel does seem to function as national allegory, that most autobiographies are not self-revelatory. They are actually indicating the place of a person within a larger movement. Or how I participated in the Indian nationalist movement could actually be a subtext, or how I participated in the reform of my community could be what follows the colon. rather like my grand title, Past Nationalism and Communism in South India, colon, Malabar, which is one district. You know, it's that kind of thing, you know, where there is a large theme and there is a smaller one. So, question that we need to ask is, why do all these autobiographies deal with the great events? It's an I too was there kind of argument that we see, the great events of reform and nationalism. One question that, when I was doing research on Kerala, one question that bothered me was the question of why all the autobiographies that I read, regardless of whether they were of social reformers or of communist politicians or of Congress politicians, ended sometime in the 1940s. Even though these autobiographies were being written in the 1970s, 1980s, it was almost as if in the 40s what had to be achieved had been achieved. Independence had been achieved, society had been transformed, and therefore there was nothing more to tell. Your life became significant only in as much it was part of that great transformation. So what are we speaking about here? Are we speaking about diffident selves? Are we speaking about abashed selves? Are we speaking about selves which find themselves only in the moment of the realization of the nation? This is a problem that we need to look at. It's not enough to say, well, we do not have the kind of interiority that characterizes the writings of the 18th century diarist in England, for example, or St. Augustine. It's not enough. What we need to understand is an immanent economy. We need to read these texts which call themselves autobiographies and find what indeed it is they are speaking about and why do they call themselves autobiography. I think that is the economy that we need to understand, the self-representation by these particular writers. So, for example, in Kanipayur's case, whom I shall come to shortly, in Kanipayur's case, he projects 4 volumes for his autobiography, and Kanipayur is a prodigious writer. Now, one reason why he's a prodigious writer is that because he publishes his own works. I mean, no other publisher would actually take on the kind of things that he used to publish, so he sets up his own press. He's a very rugged man, and he suggests a way out for most academics in these moments of financial crisis. So he projects a 4th volume. He writes 3 volumes, and he says, the 4th volume shall be my life after the age of 25. He never writes it. That volume doesn't get written. The 1st volume, till the age of 25, and the next 2 volumes, which I shall describe, are the ones we have with us. This, again, is a question. What happens? Why does he not write this 4th volume? And if you look at other autobiographies, again, you find that, and this is just an example that I'll cite, of A.K. Gopalan, who is probably the most important communist leader in Kerala, mass organizer. He has this sentence which comes halfway through the book. So there is this life of feudal decadence that he describes, where he used to go hunting and he was a member of one of the most important families. And then he says, I converted to communism, and this is the phrase that he uses, I converted to communism and I suddenly realized that the qualities of sin, greed, jealousy and intrigue, which were part of my character, had to be got rid of. Now, one would think that those were the characteristics that actually continue within the Communist Party, but that's besides the point. So he says, that is the point where I decided to jettison all of this. So it's a bit like that St. Paul's moment of being blinded on the road to Damascus. It's that moment where he suddenly realizes that individualism is a characteristic of feudalism. This is an interesting characterization. Those individual traits, to become modern for him, is to actually lose his individuality within a larger collective movement. So there is a different posing of the problem that we need to take up. And this idea I shall take up again. How the problem of modernity seems to be posed very differently in the kinds of texts that I'm looking at. That individuality may be a sign of decadence rather than of breaking free, of establishing oneself. I mean, this is a trope. Now, I'm not saying that this is the argument that I'm putting forward, but this is a trope that surfaces. I shall just give you two recent examples. We have Tanika Sarkar's work to move away from Kerala, because very often in Indian history, Indian historians tend to work on their region and read nothing on other regions, which I think is a significant failing. And if one is thinking about Indian history, one has to read all of it. And so when one looks at the work that's appearing in other regions, Tanika Sarkar's work on Rajsundari Devi. Rajsundari Devi is the first Bengali woman to write an autobiography. It's in the 1870s. She's an ordinary housewife. She writes her autobiography taking time away from her domestic work. I mean, it's not as if she's an intellectual, somebody who comes out of the Bengal Renaissance. She is a housewife. So when she writes her autobiography, it's very interesting to see that each of the chapters is prefaced with a passage from the life of Chaitanya, the Chaitanya Bhagavat. Chaitanya, who is a great Vaishnavite saint. So it's almost as if the sacred sanctifies the profane telling of her own life. Now the question to be asked here is this not autobiography then? Is this something that is trapped within a religiosity? Is this, should autobiographies be a secular rendering? Now all of these are questions that we need to ask, rather than saying, well, the answer is very simple. In India, when somebody sets out to write an autobiography, they can locate themselves within a hagiographical tradition, and voila, we have the individual. I think there's something much more complicated that is happening here in terms of an interaction between traditions. Or again, when we look at Sudipto Kaviraj's work on Bankimchandra, again, when you have Bankimchandra writing the life of Krishna, what is he doing? Is he writing the life of Krishna, the god? Or is he creating for himself? Is Bankimchandra creating for himself a role model of a real politic individual, where he says, my Krishna is not the Krishna of the Puranas, who hangs around with the gopis by moonlight dallying. My Krishna is the master strategist of the Bhagavad Gita and the Mahabharata. And so he's actually creating a role model for himself. So what is he doing here? It's again a modern engagement with a text. So what I'm suggesting is that perhaps when we look for autobiography, we ought to be casting our net wide in terms of the genres that we are engaging with, as also to try and understand the internal economy of this, rather than measuring it against some impossible paradigm. Because even in the West, when one thinks about the novel, Charles Dickens is a novelist, so is James Joyce. Now, as to what they have in common is left to other departments to figure out. It's not my business. So what about Kanipayur, Shankaran Nambudiripad, the person that I'm speaking about? Here we find a whole set of instances that he's actually putting forward, where he presents an aesthetic and an ethical approach, where he says that history, it's not that we should write better history, but that we should write better. Now what does he mean by that? It's not about writing better charitram, but doing better writing. For him, history is something that's ideological. History is built around the interests of particular groups. That history is something about a structured forgetting. Right? That is what history essentially is. It's a structured forgetting rather than a structured remembering. The more history is produced, the more that gets sidelined and silenced. So he says better writing would mean the revelation of fact, no matter how unpleasant they are, about society. So he says what I'm trying to do in this autobiography is to write better, not write a better history. So to tell you about instances from the past, flattering, unflattering, and otherwise. And here what we are looking at is the peculiar phenomenon of a person who writes an autobiography, which is called Endesmaranagal, or My Memories, where he does not speak about himself at all. He's completely absent throughout he doesn't tell you where he was born, his inner feelings, or he describes society around him, and he describes all kinds of things, and that is the puzzle that I'm trying to unravel before you. He describes bus stations, for example, he describes the water wheel, he describes ornaments, he doesn't describe himself. He talks about pollution, he talks about all kinds of pollution in terms of ritual pollution, ceremonies, and so on. So how do we understand this autobiography, which calls itself an autobiography without the biography bit of it, or the auto bit of it? So he writes, so why am I writing, is the question that he puts before us. And he says that what I am trying to do when I write, and here we begin to get an indication of the nature of autobiography, as he puts it. He says we live in times of tremendous change, and change traumatizes individuals. Change is difficult for individuals, particularly in, as he sees, modernity has produced changes in Kerala, where Kerala moved from a caste society to a communist society in the span of one generation. Right? So he argues that writing is an attempt to resolve the trauma that individuals face. Writing autobiographies, which depict the broadest possible canvas, allows individuals to realize themselves by addressing the trauma of change. So he says it's a bit like when caterpillars become butterflies, and that's the metaphor he uses. Caterpillars are more capable of defending themselves than butterflies. And he sees the coming of modernity as when caterpillars, who are certainly ugly but capable of looking after themselves, now become butterflies but lead an existence without meaning. It's an existence without any symbolic significance. It's an existence which is defenseless. It's beautiful, perhaps. So this metaphor of caterpillars to butterflies is something that comes up, and he argues that the very act of recording, it's like a bearing witness. So the act of writing an autobiography is to bear witness to a time and to institutions which existed within which individuals were moored. So being an individual was being a person who was defined within a field of force. It was not about somebody who stood alone on a landscape. It's necessary to fill in that landscape to realize one's true individuality. This is the argument that he makes. So it's a bit like Eliot's famous statement, these fragments have I showed against my ruin. So he's speaking about the destruction around him, and he's recovering from that change the moments which actually help to moor the individual. So what he's speaking about is the field of force within which an individual realizes himself or herself. And for him, the autobiography is recording the end of a symbolic order which no longer exists. And so whenever he speaks about a personal detail, so he say, my mother gave birth to my younger sister. And then there is a description of the rituals that attended birth, the kind of pollution a woman was open to, the kinds of rituals which involved larger sections of the community where dependents would come, place gifts, would be gifted in return, all of that. So there is a constant oscillation between the individual event and the larger community or the larger symbolic order of which it was part. And men exist within rituals of eternal purification. And this is a very, one would argue, I mean, if I were being anachronistic, I would argue this is a very postmodern text, in the sense that selfhood is something that is seen as very fragile. Selfhood is seen as something that needs to be reasserted. It is constantly prone to fragmentation. So for the Brahmin male, the notion of being a Brahmin male is something that is structured through ritual, through the morning prayer, through the afternoon prayer, through festivals, through association with temple rituals, through recognition by kings, by feudal lords. It's that entire field of force through which the Brahmin creates himself day by day. Right? It's not a self that's given. So here again, when you think about the individual as described by Kanipayur bears some notion, if one is being frivolous, to the kind of hybridity that people are speaking about these days. I mean, so I'm just making a very facetious parallel, because now we take pleasure in identity. We can be what we want, when we want, and where we want to be. So this idea of people constantly creating themselves, a sense of identity and selfhood being fragile, the notion of a self which constantly has to be renewed. And one instance of this is the record of what pollution can do. So there's one chapter which is called Aitam, or pollution, where he says that, let's take a simple example. He says the inside of the mouth is polluting. And let us imagine, he says, somebody who eats and puts his hand inside his mouth, then he does not wash his hand, he touches a knife. That knife is used by somebody to cook. That pollutes them, it pollutes what is cooked. Then somebody eats that food and they get polluted. And so from that individual act, you imagine a whole society. It's like a, you know, it's like the spread of a virus almost. So it is precisely to prevent this that the entire world comes to be structured through a kind of ritual which emphasizes a pure individual becomes then the focus of individuality, but that pure individual does not remain eternally pure, it has to be constantly renewed. So then how do you write a life? And he says, well, if I have to write my life, the real lives, as he puts it, and here there is more than a hint of irony, he says the real lives are led by people like Rajendra Prasad, Mahatma Gandhi, Jawaharlal Nehru. What can I tell of my life? You know, my life, humble, simple, and so on. And he says, and it's interesting, that I would not have written my autobiography, he says, had I not been requested by, and he names a gentleman, Kuchipura Krishnavilla, who happened to be the leading rationalist and atheist of his time, a man who was engaged in writing about science in Malayalam, bringing, you know, informing Malayalis about Newton, Galileo, Einsteinian physics, and so on. So it's interesting that the request to write an autobiography comes from somebody outside Kanipayur's own paradigm. So, and here is Kanipayur's reply. Kanipayur says, and here it's a quotation, I have no difficulty in writing my life history. In the morning, I bathed, had coffee, ate, had a mid-morning coffee, ate dinner, and slept. This completes a history of a day. The next day's history would consist of changing the date and writing ditto for the rest of the days. I am now 68 years of age. For all the days that I have lived, writing ditto would suffice for a life history. But I do not have the courage to publish this record. If my friend is prepared to publish this, I shall hand over copyright free of cost. What is interesting here is that the entire life of modernity, as you can see, is something that appears vacuous. Right? It consists of acts which are repetitive, it consists of acts which are meaningless, in some sense devoid of meaning. But it's important here that this is particularly the view of somebody who is not given to labor. Right? It reflects a particular view of somebody whose life is structured by reflection rather than labor. So for somebody else writing his life, their life would not consist merely of eating and sleeping and so on. They would have to work for their living, presumably. And this kind of debate about the meaninglessness of modernity is something that comes up in the debates on the discourse of the novel at that time as well. So when the first novel is written in Malayalam in the late 1880s, the debates say, well, why should we be interested in the lives of X and Y who fall in love with one another? You look at Rama and Sita falling in love, that means something. That is something that has moral meaning. It has cosmic significance. But X gardener's son falling in love with Y boatman's daughter? Yeah, what is this? It conveys nothing. So this reflects a particular mindset. Now, I'm making a specific kind of argument here about one particular Brahmin's engagement with the notions of autobiography and modernity. Let me clarify that from the very beginning. It's not something that I say, well, this reflects an Indian viewpoint and that this I sanction this. But what I'm interested in here is this notion of what constitutes a life, right? As far as Kanipayura is concerned. And for him, as far as modernity is concerned, modernity constitutes a site of the impossibility of autobiography. Autobiography is possible only within a certain kind of traditional life, where each individual act has a resonance and a meaning much beyond the individual life. So for him, modernity is devoid of content. It consists of people going through repetitive acts, eating, waking, sleeping, and so on and so forth. It's a tedium of modernity. So the question he's asking is, how is the self constituted? How can the self be constituted within an empty field of force rather than a symbolic field of force? Of course, when he thinks about the notion of change, he says that the notion of inevitable change, he says, well, change is inevitable, it'll happen. Changes in Kerala have been unthinkable, as he put, achintyam and viplavatmagam, evolutionary. But it is also natural. He says change will happen. So all these changes that have happened in Kerala in terms of caste movements, one must really see it as a storm in a teacup. Because no kings have been killed, as in the French Revolution. What has happened to the people of and he's very ironic again, which is why I call him a conservative modern. He says, well, some people weren't allowed to grow moustaches, now they grow moustaches. Some people weren't allowed to wear slippers, they grow slippers. Women couldn't cover their breasts, and now they do, and so on. So he naturalizes change. So I'll just take up the three volumes right now, and I shall give you a brief indication. I think I have 15 more minutes. So the first volume, which is his life up to 25 years, as I said, has no record of himself, but the symbolic order in which the individual lives. So there are the chapters on the connections that the Kanipayur family had with the king of Travancore, with the king of Calicut, with prominent families, divans, and so on. Then there are chapters on daily rituals. It's really Foucauldian technologies of the self. It's how the self comes to be created. That's really what is being written about. Daily rituals, questions of purity and pollution, and also questions of dominance and dependence. So there are chapters, entire chapters on forms of address. How do you address a Brahmin? How do you address a lower caste? And it is in that field of, and it's in the listing of those words. And this seems, when you read the book, the sense that you get is of Flaubert's Bouvard and Pécuchet, that impossible listing of things. The list is endless in this. It just goes on and on of all kinds of things. And this listing of names that happens as to how a person of a particular caste, a particular place on the hierarchy can address another, that itself again signifies individuality within a larger field of force. Right? So, and one chapter begins, and here is where we begin to look at some of the complications of this. Rather like Jane Austen's novel, it is a fact universally acknowledged that a man in possession of property needs a wife. You know, this chapter begins very much a fact universally acknowledged that those in possession of property need servants, both male and female. That's how he begins. And then when he thinks about this whole chapter on servitors and on servants, what he's actually arguing is that the Nayars, the caste who come next in the hierarchy, the dominant Shudra caste in Kerala, the Nayars are nothing but the servants of the Nambudris. Now, this is something that is contrary to historical and social fact, in the sense that the Nayars were the ruling elite in many cases. They were the landowning families. Some of them came from kingly families, because the Nayars encompass an entire range, from the humble Menon, who is an accountant, to the king. So he argues that the Nayars were nothing but the servitors of the Nambudris, and the Nayars represented the interface with pollution. So whenever Nambudri Brahmins were likely to be in a state of pollution, that is when the Nayar had to come in to act as the interface between them and that pollution. So in the writing of this history, in the depiction of this field of force, there is something interesting that is happening here. There is a freezing that is happening, and I shall return to this point later. There is a freezing of a particular moment in Kerala's history, and representing that as the history of Kerala, the history of the self. So here I'm just trying to get at some of the tensions which appear in the text as well. And so he writes a partial history here. There were certain Nayars, certainly in the relation of servitors, but that's not the entire history. But this becomes his representation. And he argues that when one thinks about traditional society, it's not about dependence, it's not about power, it's about affect. Right? It is about emotional relations, it's about duty, it's about kartavyam, or what people need to do. And so the entire field of force is depicted as one that is constructed by affect, by ritual, and by notions of interdependence, such as that of the Jajmani. Right? So which is why the notion of the symbolic field becomes important. Because in the writing of this autobiography, to anticipate the argument that I'm trying to make, he does not write about himself, because his self, in some sense, has ceased to exist with the vanishing of that field of force. The revolutionary transformation that has happened in Kerala through social reform, through communism, has taken away all the markers through which he constituted himself as a Brahmin. And this is a point that I shall return to. So the autobiography is about how I lost my sense of self, could be one way of putting it, or right, and that transition. So here we are moving to another stage in the argument. So it's interesting how he also inverts a lot of the categories. So he argues that modernity is characterized by an excess of affect. So that is to say that, you know, people show love towards each other. People demonstrate on the streets, political processions, and so sloganeering and so on. So it's a very an argument which is actually the opposite of what Norbert Elias would actually say. Interdependence and restraint on the affect characterizing the transition to modernity, and in different forms you have Foucault arguing the same thing. Here it's the reverse, where he says that traditional societies, power consisted of boundedness. Individuality consisted of a certain kind of boundedness within a field of force. And he has this incredibly funny story of this Brahmin father who is lying on his deathbed, and his children are huddled around him, and they're all extremely anguished that he's about to leave them to go on to a better or worse world. And one of the sons is so agitated that when the father shuts his eyes, he calls out, "Father," and the father wakes up in great anger, and he says, "Yes, son," and this man is shattered, you know, because they've never addressed themselves as father and son throughout their entire life. The display of affect was something that was to be avoided at all costs. So he says modernity is something that again has led to this release of affect. The restraint on affect is what characterized individuality. And this, the first volume also then deals with questions like connections to the royal family, as I said, the notion of purity and pollution. And whenever history comes in as a cautionary tale. So he says that the two instances in the first volume where there is an indication of a larger history as we know it, he says that all the Nambudris who have gained English education have become haters of the community. Or he says that, well, tobacco chewing is not much practiced among Brahmins. It's only those who have become communists who now smoke. And so on. So there are these indications of a larger history, but that's kept at bay. So this is an autobiography of a conservative modern. Remember, that's the larger framework we're arguing with. The second volume, if the first volume is really looking at these technologies of the self, so to put it, the second volume is a discourse on objects. So you have chapters on vehicles of various kinds, rickshaws and horse-drawn carriages. You have huge descriptions, chapters on lamps, various kinds of lamps, hand lamps, lamps which are hung from the ceiling, lamps to be carried, lamps to be transported on cart, and so on and so forth. There are various forms of irrigation, various instruments for writing, ranging from the palm leaf stylus to other more advanced on iron, gold, steel, there are, and so on and so forth. There are also chapters on domestic animals, and there are chapters on cinema halls, hotels, and so on. Now here again we go back to the argument that I have presented before you, that this is about how I lost myself. Each of these objects were objects which defined Kanipayur. Right? So if you think about why he would speak about bus stations and cinema halls in an autobiography, these are precisely the spaces in which it no longer makes sense to be a Brahmin. These are spaces of anonymity. In a bus station, everybody gathers together. In a bus, everyone sits together. In a cinema hall, everyone sits together. In the darkness, who is a Brahmin, who is a Shudra, it's difficult to tell. So the description of these objects, the removal of a field of force, the loss of that sense of self is what constitutes his autobiography. So here we have a very interesting act, not a self-revelation, which is what autobiography is about. It's about the self-abnegation. It's about how a self ceases to exist once a particular field of force has vanished. Now, this discourse on objects is very interesting because if you look at a lot of the early novels, whether in any language, early Indian novels in any Indian language from the 19th century onwards, every novel mentions objects in profusion. So they will describe living rooms. They will tell you there is a clock hung on the wall. They'll mention cupboards. One cupboard holding Sanskrit books, one cupboard holding English books to show the dichotomous life of the Indian bourgeoisie. And they mention clocks, pear soap, candy, all kinds of things. You know, there's a profusion, there's a whole discourse of objects that happens in the novels. So objects within the novel, Malayalam novels, signify modernity. It's what Timothy Breen, in a wonderful article called The Baubles of Modernity, which is an article on the American Revolution, as to how England became palpable within the American bourgeoisie's household because of the terms of trade. An American waking up at home in the 18th century would look around his house and see English objects all around him. So there was that palpable presence of a colonial. So here too, it's a palpable presence of modernity in the discourse of objects in the novel. For Kanipayur, the discourse on objects is the presence of those objects which define his power. So to take for example, if you think about writing implements, only Brahmins could write. So he records all those instruments, and it's a very Hitchcockian. And now we move to the second thing, where there are a lot of photographs. Throughout the text, there are photographs, and in each of these photographs, Kanipayur himself is present, holding the pen, sitting on a carriage being drawn by the lower castes, holding an umbrella, only upper castes were allowed that privilege. It's again freezing time at that point when the self existed. Now none of those are the markers of an identity. Again, the autobiography of a vanished self. The third volume deals with the traditional history of the Nambudris. It deals with naming. And here it's much more about the relations of Nambudris with others through marriage, through festive dances, through annual rituals and so on. So it's actually the first and the third volume I'm really speaking about in detail at the moment. So when we think about the photographs, and here I'll just quickly summarize, and that will give me 4 more minutes and I can wind up. So photographs, if you look at the photographs, there is a parallel discourse that is happening with the text. Right? It's kind of buttressing the sense of an absent self or a dissolving self. And it is also, in some sense, it's a parallel discourse with colonial anthropology. Because if you look at a lot of these photographs, they could very well have come out of Edgar Thurston's Cast and Tried for Southern India, all those innumerable volumes that were produced. But what is significant here is that if anthropology was concerned with actually presenting a past, right, which was the past of the present, so to speak, it's what Fabian would call the denial of coevalness. So you present the African, the lower caste, as the past of the present society. You don't live in the same time, even though you occupy the same space. What you have here, when Kani Payur does these photographs, it is for him not a denial of coevalness. He actually lives in those photographs. Those photographs represent for him the moment when he was actually himself, when he was an individual. So it is actually collapsing time. And that Hitchcockian presence in all of those photographs is something that is significant and worth thinking about. So in the photographs, as I said, one, they were the object that defined self. So it could be the implements of writing, signifying Brahmanhood, ritual utensils, with which he performed the various rituals through which the self was renewed day by day. Or they were the lamps used at various festivals and so on. Then there were the objects that defined power, carriages, umbrellas, and so on. Then you have the objects which define abhijatyam, as he calls it, a pedigree. And he says, as you go up a mountain, there's less and less space at the top. That's what pedigree really is. And so objects defining abhijatyam, and here most Nambudiri women wore just a waist cloth. The breasts were uncovered till as late as the 1920s and 1930s, because most Nambudiri women were confined to the home. Whenever they went out, they would throw a drape a cloth over themselves and carry a huge umbrella with which they could mask themselves. So the objects are defined abhijatyam, and here he gets into a kind of problem, because he has to show these women wearing those ornaments which signified their wealth and their pedigree and status. But he also says that nowadays, and he's writing this book in the 1960s, he says nowadays women are not amenable to appearing before a photographer, you know, wearing next to nothing. So he uses paintings instead to depict women of another time. And there's only one photograph of a lady, presumably a servitor in the household, with her eyes blacked out, as you would find, you know, in these, like you would find on the best of BBC reporting or in contemporary crime journals which come out, you know, so as to not identify the person. So the photographs are all actually speaking about these frozen moments when there was a field of force within which there was a sense of self. So to wind up, I'll just get into some of the debates and some of the ways of thinking about this. So how do we think about interdependence and the restraint on affect? And there is a way in which Kani Payur is in some sense running, posing an argument that's contra our own understanding of modernity. So as I pointed out, I mean, this whole notion that restraint on the affect was a characteristic of older society, modernity is characterized by a display of affect, the certain forms of interdependence which characterized traditional societies, which do not characterize modernity, because the kind of interdependence that characterized traditional societies was what constituted the symbolic order within which being an individual made sense. So it's not like the Eliasian notion of interdependence, where he has this wonderful example of the traffic. You know, how do cars move about on the roads and nobody bangs into one another, even though we do not know the intentions of the other driver? That there is a certain notion of interdependence which allows the moving of traffic. Here, Kani Payur is working with a certain notion of interdependence which is part of a symbolic order which constitutes the individual. There is also the recourse to history. And here, one of the interesting points that I would like to make, and this is one part of the work. The paper that I'm writing looks at autobiography and the three volumes of the history that he wrote, the history of Kerala, because for me, these are parts of the same imagination. So for example, to give you a very simple example, if you look at Jawaharlal Nehru's Discovery of India and you read Jawaharlal Nehru's autobiography, it's very difficult to tell which is which. The autobiography is about his discovery of India, and the discovery of India is indeed his autobiography. So I think it's important not to separate the genres too much. And for me, to elaborate Kani Payur's universe of imagination, as well as his sense of self, I need to put the history that he writes of Kerala as well as the autobiography that he writes alongside one another. And that's a project that I can talk about later if there's time. But what is interesting here is that in the book that he calls very clearly Aryam Marude Kudiyettam, the colonization by the Aryans, is the history that he writes of Kerala, in which he has several very, very interesting speculations about how the Brahmins came to Kerala. He suggests that just as Columbus discovered America, the Brahmins discovered Kerala, because had the Brahmins come by land, they would have been sullied by all that interaction with other tribes and so on. So they came by sea in a pure state, landed in Kerala, so we're the purest form of Brahminhood in Kerala and so on. But one of the interesting things here is that here again there is a relation to modernity that we need to think about, because at the beginning there's an unexceptionable account of how history should be written. Where he says, one, we should be objective, and he says we should not commit the Himalayan blunder of introducing our own emotions and our own evaluations. So history is about objectivity. He says history is about realism, to show things as they really are. So if I paint a portrait of my father and he's blind in one eye, he's knock-kneed, and he has a crazy grin, that's how I should paint him, rather than paint him as a manifestation of Rama. And he also says that what he must write is a social history. So there are shades of Ranker, there are shades of E.P. Thompson, shades of, it's an unexceptionable program of history that he puts out. But when he does write his history, it's a history that's very deliberately written from a Brahmin standpoint. It's about how Kerala is the creation of the Brahmins. Now here I'm doing something naughty, which is not the space of this paper, I'll end here, which is to actually compare the autobiography and the history with the writings of the man who was the first communist chief minister in Kerala, another Nambudiri Brahmin, E.M.S. Nambudiri Pad, and to show the shared universe that these two, a conservative Brahmin at one end of the spectrum and a radical Brahmin, share. Now that's a paper that I've already published, which is called Being a Brahmin, the Marxist Way, which is on E.M.S. Nambudiri Pad's History of Kerala, to show how, when it comes to the crunch, the imagination that they rely on is a Brahmin imagination. So when we think about, and I'll end here, the debates that Dipesh Chakravarti has initiated, for example, where in that rhetorical flourish where he argues that we must provincialize Europe, that Europe has too long been a part of our imagination, and we structure our histories in terms of European imagination and so on. It's very clear in Kanepayur's text and in a lot of regional language texts that Europe has been provincialized already. Right? There is a deference paid to the idea of Europe. There is a deference paid to the notion of history. As I said, Kanepayur's introduction could be taught in most history programs as a program for writing unexceptionable history. But when he does write history, it's something that acknowledges this, but proceeds to write it very much as he would. So Europe is already provincialized, so maybe we don't need to visit that argument anymore. Thank you.